From the Gospel according to Mark, chapter 14, verses 41 through 64. When Jesus returned the third time, he said, "Are you still sleeping and resting? That is enough. The hour is come. Look, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. See, my betrayer is approaching." While Jesus was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived, accompanied by a crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests, scribes, and elders. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them, "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away securely." Going directly to Jesus, he said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. Then the man seized Jesus and arrested him. And one of the bystanders drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Jesus asked the crowd, "Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as you would an outlaw? Every day I was with you teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. But this has happened that the scriptures would be fulfilled." Then everyone deserted him and fled. One young man who'd been following Jesus was wearing a linen cloth around his body. They caught hold of him, but he pulled free of the linen cloth and ran away naked. They led Jesus away to the high priest, and all the chief priests, elders, and scribes assembled, and Peter followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he sat with the officers and warmed himself by the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they did not find any, for many bore false witness against Jesus, but their testimony was inconsistent. Then some men stood up and testified falsely against him. "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this man-made temple, and in 3 days I will build another that is made without hands.'" But even their testimony was inconsistent. So the high priest stood up before them and questioned Jesus, "Have you no answer? What are these men testifying against you?" But Jesus remained silent and made no reply. Again, the high priest questioned him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus, "and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." At this, the high priest tore his clothes and declared, "Why do we need any more witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What is your verdict?" And they all condemned him as deserving of death. Please pray with me. Lord Jesus, you went through all of this, and you did this graciously and nobly and in great love. Lord, show us that love. Help us to receive that love, and help us to know the meaning of humility in some important ways. We thank you now and praise you for all of this in your name. Amen. Please be seated. Forgive these sips of water now and again. My throat's doing the dry throat thing today. All right, Gospel of Mark. Things moved quickly through the first 11 chapters, and then we sort of divided things up a little bit differently. So we've been dealing with Mark 12, but not the triumphal entry, because that's next Sunday, right? Palm Sunday already. But we've talked about the Last Supper and questions and answers as they tried to entrap him subtly. And then we talked about Judas, and we talked about the greatest commandment, which was not a trap, but the rest of it had been a trap. We talked about the garden, boasts and failures. We talked about the end of the world as we know it. And then today we're talking about the arrest of trial. And then on Wednesday, we're talking about Jesus being anointed for burial, or what happens when worship smells like a junior high dance. And if you want to know, come on Wednesday. The soup will be great. And we'll talk about what happens when worship smells like a junior high dance. We've discussed the Last Supper and Judas. We discussed Jesus in the garden. And as you will recall, as we talked about this last time, Jesus is in anguish and agony before things get moving, right? He's going to be moving from trial to other things once things get going. But he's this last moment before things get crazy. He knows the cross is coming, and the cross is agony and torture. And so he is with his friends in the garden, and he is seeing this all loom up on him, and he sees the sin of the world laid on him, which is probably the greatest thing that we can't even understand what that looks like, what that feels like. We were born with sin intermixed with us, but for a holy and sinless God to receive all of that sin, it is beyond understanding. But he is so stressed that he is sweating blood, and he tells his friends to stay here with him and to keep watch. And of course, they can't. Their eyes are heavy. They have no answer. They're weak. And he is sympathetic to our weakness as well. And then from there, then we move into Jesus's arrest and trial. And you know what happens, and we talk about what happens. But really what we're left with, if we're going to talk about his arrest and trial, there's some stuff we need to realize conceptually, because we've not often talked about his trial, but it's a good thing to understand all of this. There's some stuff that happens as you look at those events that describe his trial the way Mark recounts it. And for any society, for the most part, you're going to have written laws, even if they're not strictly written. They're going to be your legal code. There's going to be your you shall do this and you shall not do that. And if you shall do this, you will not run into problems. But if you don't do what you shall do, then you're going to run into some crimes and we're going to have to enact punishment. And if you do do what you shall not do, same deal. That's your legal code. In the United States, we have the Constitution and we have legislation on all levels that tell you what you should and shouldn't do. People telling you what to do, Americans don't like it. Yeah, that's true, but as surely as the speed limit is 55 and you all keep it, right? That's how the legal code works. In Israel, Exodus through Deuteronomy spells out their legal code. That's, again, all the commands, the basic stuff that you're responsible for. In contrast to this, sometimes they're called unwritten laws, but they might actually be written down. The idea behind it is, in addition to the laws that tell you what you should and shouldn't do, there's the procedural stuff that's going to spell out how we then go about doing our policing and how we're going to go about acting in a court. And you're not responsible, for the most part, to know how the police are supposed to act. You just have to know how you're supposed to act if the police want to arrest you. And that is, yes, sir. Right? If there's a problem, they take you down to the precinct and you handle it at the precinct. It's that simple. That's actually how you avoid running into problems. Okay? But you don't need to know all the stuff that the police need to know. That's the sort of a thing that actually will even vary to a minor degree from state to state, municipality to municipality. Similarly, courtroom procedure. By the way, Perry Mason is a lie, okay? Every other TV show in court is a lie. Just so that you know, I have watched my dad's body language when he watches those things and he kind of winces, and with good reason, because it actually doesn't work that way. Courtroom procedure is nothing that you need to know. Why? Because first of all, behave yourself and you won't have to find out. But second of all, because we provide you with counsel who will tell you, no, please do not stand up right now. Let me do the talking for you. We've got someone to guide you through that. All of that is an extra layer for how a society handles its legal procedures. And it shifts some over time. Our courts behave a bit differently now than they did 50 to 70 years ago. Not radically, but a little bit. That also was the case in Israel. Don't believe me? By the way, the word Sanhedrin does not really occur in the Old Testament. It occurs in a few places because it's a word for council or seated council. And it even refers to occasionally about two places where the men are sitting in the gates. They're gathered and doing a seated council as they handle cases. But it's a local council, and certainly you don't have it describing the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court of Israel. That's all right. That's because nations shift, and when you're an agrarian society where you've got towns and small communities and you're handling a lot of stuff more decentralized, that's going to function one way. As you start to get larger cities, you're going to have to try more cases more often, and so you have to deal with more things, and then you start to deal with more points of order as your economy becomes more complicated and stuff like that. So there's going to be some flexing with that unwritten, if you will, or those procedures that aren't necessarily your laws. Laws will possibly change. They're not supposed to change a whole lot in Israel, right? Because God gave the law. But for the most part, right, procedure is subject to a certain amount of changing. Fun Sanhedrin facts, in case you were wondering, because we have to put the fun in Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin, as I said, is probably from the word for seated or seated council. It could refer to local councils because every town had them for handling everyday sorts of stuff. If you were speeding on your ox, you're going to answer to your local town council. Okay, you probably could have gone faster walking, but it kind of depends upon how badly you goaded him. All right. It also refers to the Great Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court in all of Israel. It had its chamber in Jerusalem, and it was composed of 71 members, ideally composed along these lines. It wasn't always ideal. Sometimes you had a few, one more of one than the other, but 23 priests, 23 scribes, and 23 elders or elder senior members of the community. Add into that a man who serves as the president, who is called the prince, and a man who serves as vice president, who is called the father of the assembly, and that's your Sanhedrin. Okay? All of the members have to be at least 40 years old, because we don't want no impulsive young buck trying to mess things up. Additionally, all members had to be educated and men of good character. What do I mean by educated? They were expected actually to have enough of a grasp of the sciences to be able to handle whatever arguments might be brought to a court. And that, by the way, did require a certain amount of education to be conversant with those things. They were required also to be fluent in whatever languages were predominant in the area, because the idea is you may end up having to deal with testimony from people who might not speak Aramaic or Greek, or you need to be able to speak the majority of the languages going on there. So these guys are, again, educated. Additionally, your character's got to be proven good. There's certain parts of life that you are automatically excluded from ever serving on the Sanhedrin if this is who you are. For example, if you are given to gambling or drunkenness, forget it. Drunkenness, because that's ungodly, right? God says as much in the Word. Gambling, because in Jewish thinking, they lumped gambling, even just casual gaming, they would lump that in the same broad category as stealing. And so if you're going to do that, we're not going to put you on the court. We're not going to arrest you for that, but we're not going to put you on the court. So also, if you didn't take the time to teach your children the law, then you're not going to be really expected to be a candidate for serving on the Sanhedrin, even if you know the law really well, because there was a maxim that they had, which was, he who does not teach his children the law is just about interchangeable with he who teaches his children to steal. Okay? So character matters in this. Certain amount of wisdom and life matters. You were elite in the community if, in point of fact, you were part of the Sanhedrin. There was no money in this, but man, people would give an awful lot just for the honor. It met about twice a week. It could be called for special meetings beyond that. And there was no money to be made in this, so you had to be wealthy enough to where you didn't need to worry about work, or to where you could cover your working needs even while having 2 days a week in the court. All of this is useful if we're going to talk about Jesus' trial, because this is the group of people that are going to be trying him, and they were governed by certain procedures. It's a well-known book at this point, somewhat famous book. It's been loved, it's been not appreciated, there's some debate on it, but it's a good starting point anyway. It's The Trial of Jesus from a Lawyer's Standpoint, written by William N. Chandler in 1908. And it analyzes the Sanhedrin's regulations for how to conduct a trial. Now, he takes it from the Talmud, which unfortunately is not written down until somewhere between the 2nd and 4th centuries, but it was the tradition that was being handed down for how the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem was supposed to behave. So, while not all of this may not have been perfectly in place, this is ballpark how they're supposed to be doing things. And so it's a reasonable, good starting place. All right? He examines Jesus' trial then in light of this. So, procedural details that you should be aware of, all right? First of all, you're not allowed to arrest people without an appropriate cause or an accusation of some kind. We can't just arrest you and then this is not a banana republic where we're then going to figure out what we're going to charge you with. It doesn't work that way. Trials have to be public. They have to be held in the Sanhedrin's chamber, which was in the temple precincts. It was called the Hall of Hewn Stone, in case you wanted to know, or in case you were writing a comic book, because I think that a hero's, you know, base could be the Hall of Hewn Stone. That just sounds cool, right? Trials must occur after the morning sacrifice is offered at the temple and must conclude for the day by sunset. All right, you can't have a trial after dark. That's not supposed to happen. Capital cases require two sessions with at least an overnight in between the two. Why? Because we don't want to be hasty if a man's life is on the line. So therefore, we're going to slow this down. We're going to deliberate. We're going to talk. And we're not going to rush because life is important. Accused people were supposed to be treated with a presumption of innocence. Oh, that sounds familiar. Yeah, we do that sort of a thing too. Witnesses were supposed to be examined separately and rigorously ahead of a person being put on trial, because your witness, generally speaking, is your accuser. In fact, in a capital crime, the witness was required to serve as initial executioner back when Israel had the ability to put its own people to death. Because if you were the one bringing the accusation, you needed to be willing to throw the first stone, which is a very, very different sort of a take on the let him who's without sin throw the first stone. But that's some of what's behind that life and death sort of a thing. Unanimous guilty verdicts automatically invalidated a trial. What? Yeah, if the entire Sanhedrin says this man deserves to die, clearly there's got to be collusion going on, because Jews are argumentative. In fact, people are argumentative. If you've got 71 people discussing whether this guy should be put to death or not, at least one person is going to say, you know, I'm not really certain that this warrants that. So they automatically had that safety guard in there. You were also not supposed to be given any self-incriminating or leading questions if you were the accused, okay? You can't be allowed to incriminate yourself. You can't be made to bear witness against yourself. That's not permitted according to the rules. Automatic invalidation of a trial. Automatic acquittal. If there's evidence of false or contradictory witnesses, first of all, their testimony is thrown out. You've got two disagreeing witnesses, invalid. If that's where your source of accusation is, acquitted, you're free. If there's evidence of bias among those hearing the trial, right? First of all, if you're biased, if this involves you, you're supposed to recuse yourself. But if there's evidence of bias, mistrial, you're acquitted. If there's undue haste to convict, as I said, right? If it looks like we're moving this along too quickly, then we think that probably this is not concerned about justice. So the guy's acquitted. He gets to go because justice is not doing the job right. And again, as I said, if there's a unanimous verdict, then he needs to walk. Realizing all of this, we go back to Mark 14. Jesus is in the garden, and while he's speaking, Judas is leading in his train the people who've come to arrest him. And they're sent from the priests, the scribes, and the elders. That's the group that makes up the Sanhedrin. Okay, Mark is telling you that if you understand who it is that's in the Sanhedrin. And Judas shows who the guy is they need to arrest. And they cart him away. And this is all happening, again, at night. And Jesus points out, really? You're arresting me at night? Why are you arresting me at night? I was not arming people during the day. I was not hiding out in the hills during the day. I was in the temple teaching in the day. Why are you coming and arresting me at night? Does this seem a little suspicious to you? It should be, right? Meanwhile, one of the bystanders, and I think this is one of the great evidences for this being the gospel according to Peter, it's the gospel that doesn't mention that it was Peter with the sword. cuts off the servant of the high priest's ear. Luke tells us that it hits his little ear, his earlobe, which is very, very different than that very awkward swing, and he just manages just to take the ear off, but doesn't go into the guy's shoulder, because, by the way, if you're swinging down like that, you're going into the guy's shoulder, okay? But if it's like this, then it means that the servant probably went something like, whoa, and it just, and don't think Peter was aiming to miss, all right? He was not trying to give an extra body piercing there, or something like that. So, clearly, that's your one moment of resistance. Jesus goes, but he ends up pointing out, this is suspicious, but this also is fulfilling the scriptures. And of course, none of this is a surprise to God. And it shouldn't be surprising from the get-go that if he's come to die for the world in its sin and in its injustice, you know that his trial is just not going to be a square trial in the least bit. Everyone deserts him, in fact, and this is probably one of the greater evidences for, I think, why it is that you have this being Mark's gospel. There's a line of likely speculation. It doesn't name the guy, okay, but they were led to where they did the Last Supper, the Passover meal, by a young man carrying a jar of water. And it's entirely possible that this young man, of course, was Mark. And that Mark, having seen them going, wanted to follow real quickly. He didn't want to miss out. And so really quick, rather than grab his full clothes, just sort of grabbed, like, did the toga thing. Okay, wrapped a sheet around himself, and that would get... You're in Roman-occupied areas, you know. I mean, they're wearing sheets. Why not us, you know? So he went out to the garden, and so he was wearing only a linen cloth. And the crowd was so in a rush to catch people. So you can understand why the disciples are scared, because they're in such a rush to catch anyone. The disciples are splitting, and they grab onto his sheet, and he just breaks free and runs for it. And the word there is very, very clear. There's the word for naked, meaning, you know, you're exposed, but you're not fully exposed. You ran off in a loincloth. Then there is, in fact, a word for naked running off wearing sandals and a smile. And this was naked running off wearing sandals and a smile. This is the classic Markan streaker. It only shows up in the Gospel of Mark. And I personally do believe that this is, yeah, okay, Mark saying, all right, yep, you've heard about it. That was me. Right? But what we see from this is that this is such an act of intimidation that Jesus' disciples don't just abandon him like, just going to walk away now. No, they split. They run away. Nope, don't want to go down with you. Bye, Jesus. I know what we said earlier, but no, they're gone. It's very, very aggressive and intimidating sort of a mode to bring Jesus. Turn the other cheek, Jesus. Gentle Jesus. He was, in fact, you know, gentle. Okay, he did do that thing in the temple, but still. Really? They're going to lead him off? Yeah, they're just being mean at this point. So they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and elders and scribes assembled, which is to say, the Sanhedrin assembled. Now, some of the other Gospels leave room for this being more of an interrogation than an actual trial. But by the end of this encounter, if you take Mark's word for it, they're asking for a verdict, which, by the way, means this is a trial. But this is the trial, and it is happening at the high priest's house, and it's happening in the dark. So we're not really following the rules terribly well. And Peter, of course, warms himself sitting down with the officers. He may or may not have realized until he sat down that he was sitting next to the temple police when he sat down to warm himself by the fire. But you can understand, I'm sitting next to the temple police, why he may have panicked and choked, because, oh, it's not just that someone might arrest me, it's here they are. Well, yeah. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they did not find any. Banana republics do this. No, we will arrest you now. We'll come up with a charge later on. This is the old Soviet Union. This is thugocracy. This is what people do when they're abusing power. We're not starting from having witnesses where we've got an accusation, so therefore bring him in. We don't even know what we're going to accuse him of, but we've got witnesses. And the challenge for getting witnesses may have been kind of humorously ironic, because it may end up being, anyone know Jesus? Okay, yeah, come with us. We're looking for guys who can give testimony about him. You, what have you seen Jesus do? Well, I was blind. He made me see. Okay, no, go away. Well, I was sick and he healed. Go! You know, drove demons out of it. No. Okay, who saw something that's actionable against Jesus? Because we want to. You want to get rid of Jesus? Yes, we want. Why? It would have been a challenge. You have had to get some rather seedy people or some people who were biased definitely against him, which again is another real problem. They had the verdict picked out. They just needed now a crime to go with it. And that's how they put the Son of God on trial in earth. That's the best this world can do. Have you ever had people turn against you? Have you had people be unwilling to listen to you? Have you ever seen people not willing to give you a fair shake? Yeah, that's awful, isn't it? And you can just sit back and it doesn't matter. You can be the sweetest lamb in the whole world. They're not going to see it because they've already made up their minds. They're going to find some way to get rid of you because they've already made up your mind. You've seen it. That's injustice. How does it make you feel? The nicer of you are just going to feel sad. There's very few of you, I think, who are the nicer of you. The rest of you all, you're probably going to feel mad. Hey, wait a minute. I get myself in enough trouble on my own. What are you doing with that? Yeah. This is Jesus' trial. He's going to the cross for this circus. And circus it is. And yet he remains quiet. I would not have remained quiet nearly as easily. I will say that. I will come back to this point. But like Isaiah said, and by the way, so that the scriptures may be fulfilled, he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. This is a travesty, and I got rights! Not only that, I made everything! I give you your rights! He doesn't open his mouth at all. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can recount his descendants? Jesus clearly is the one guy who's in control, because he's the one guy who's keeping it cool and in control of himself, even while everything is falling apart. And everything is falling apart in this trial, because it's just not working. Some men stand up and falsely accuse against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this man-made temple, in 3 days I will build another that is made without hands. Again, witness testimony has to have a tremendous amount of overlap. Minor, very, very minor details only can have some variation. In our courts of law, a prosecutor or a defense attorney can both pick and choose as to, no, I'm just going to ask you this question. Do not say anything about anything else, just this question. Because sometimes there might be some variation and they can kind of cover for some of that in building their case. No, in a case, a trial like this, you get a witness comes up. He gives his account. The other witnesses are not in the room. The next guy comes in, and if the story doesn't match really, really well, invalid. Invalid, which means at this point, he should have instantly been acquitted. No one brings this up. They don't bring this up. That's not surprising. He doesn't bring this up either. How well do you suffer injustice? Do you suffer injustice? Another detail that we get in the midst of this, if a false witness testifies against someone accusing him of a crime, both parties to the dispute must stand in the presence of the Lord before the priests and judges who are in office at that time. The judges will investigate thoroughly, and if the witness is proven to be a liar who has falsely accused his brother, you must do to him as he intended to do to his brother, so you must purge the evil from among you. The rest of the people will hear and be afraid, and they will never again do anything so evil among you. What they're doing is evil, and those false witnesses actually were guilty of a capital crime. Shamefully, The entire Sanhedrin is shown as being complicit in a capital crime. Jesus is on trial, but the people who are showing to be guilty and to be falling apart and running into all sorts of problems, they're not Jesus. Jesus is absolutely noble, absolutely calm, absolutely cool, even while they are shown to be murderous, violating every principle they might have, certainly an awful lot of them. There is no justice for the Son of God when the world puts him on trial. So the high priest, giving up on witnesses, we don't have any more witnesses. Fine, we'll just get it from you. We will have you incriminate yourself. Yeah, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One, right? Aren't you going to testify? Yeah, this is self-incriminating. It's forbidden. At this point, I'm really left with the fact, you look at this whole set of procedures, it's one thing to have someone subtly be unjust to you, right? You steal from me, I don't know how you're doing it, I'm going to be frustrated, I'm going to be bothered, I'm going to be hurt. That's really, really true, right? Similarly, you're saying bad things behind my back. I know it's happening. I'm not seeing it happening. I'm going to be sad. It's going to be unfortunate. But it's another thing entirely to have them do it openly, brazenly, not trying to hide it at all. It's a different thing if it's not that you're sneaking in and stealing my lunch money. You're walking up and shaming me and humbling me, you end up beating me down or threatening to beat me down, and so I just cave and give you my lunch money. There's a violation in there with the lack of subtlety. It makes me feel violated. It makes me feel pathetic. It's similarly bad when you're trying to get me and it turns out that you're not even really trying. There's a lack of artistry going on. And I understand, really, you're going to complain about injustice because of the lack of artistry? Well, yeah, I would complain about that just because of the naked brazenness. They're not even trying to be subtle. They're not trying to find some technicality. They tried that. They tried to catch him up until now. He had sweated blood. He had looked towards the cross, and now he's at a trial, and the world brought the Son of God to trial. It demonstrated that the world itself was wrong and was guilty, and it was demonstrating that it couldn't do even this right. Before he could go and die for the world, he had to bail out the world and help it with its sham trial by stepping into and incriminating himself. But he so was ready to go to the cross to die for you and for me, and for them, but that's what he did. Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? I am, said Jesus, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. This is a scene from Daniel. There is an antichrist-like figure that is trying to do all sorts of horrible things on the earth. And while this is going on, it keeps cutting away to the throne room of God, and God is setting up his court. And in the midst of all this going on, as God is holding court, Daniel says, in my vision in the night, I continued to watch and saw one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. And he was given dominion, glory, and kingship that the people of every nation and language should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. His kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. That's a true court. That is the one true court that will matter. And Jesus answers at this sham trial, are you the Son of the Blessed One? Yes, I am. And I will come and judge you. And it's somewhere between a warning and it's somewhere between a dread statement of justice. If you had half a brain, if you had seen how Jesus conducts himself, Jesus is the only guy who can walk through a crowd that was wanting to lynch him, just walk out, because that's who he is. If you had half a brain at all, you would have stopped at that moment and said, not going to do it. I'm sorry. I will follow. At this, the high priest tore his robes instead. We can't have this horrible blasphemy. We don't need any more witnesses. You've heard the blasphemy. What's your verdict? And they all condemned him, unanimous verdict, to death. Is there a single part of this trial that isn't in some way rickety, messed up, and breaking the rules? No. Generalissimos and banana republics applaud one and all. He's not getting anything in any sort of resemblance to a fair and square trial. Are you the Son of God? Guilty as charged. You'll face me one day for this. Rather than bow to him, they all called for his death. They broke all their rules. They set aside all of their ideals. And they rejected him utterly and completely because it was all going to be them and they were going to be captains of their destiny. Jesus endured the cross for you and for me and for them. But along with that, and just in order to have the privilege of doing that, and I say that privilege in a strange sort of a way, but it's a loving thing that he came to do. In order to get there, he had to endure injustice and false accusations and humbly submitted to their sham trial without opening his mouth to tell them off. I personally, if it had been, yeah, we need to find something to accuse you of, let me give you something to accuse me of. It will be true, it will not be blasphemous, but I will tell you exactly what kind of idiots you people are, right? He doesn't do that. He has no sin of pride holding him back. Instead, in love, he simply speaks the truth and submits to it all because he had come here to die for you and for me and for them. And somehow, this makes his love at the cross all the more profound, that he goes through the effort, the humbling. Where are you in your own heart? You driven by pride? You are. We all are. To varying degrees. Pride is talked about as being one of the most horrible, damaging sins. Pride is very, very good at getting in the way of love being able to do what it needs to do. You consumed by injustices done to you? I have a hard time forgetting them, truth be told. I keep dreaming of how I'm going to undo that one thing that was done to me that was a bogus sort of a rap that I got in eighth grade. Are you contemptuous of the unjust for what they did to you? Are you contemptuous of the fact that sometimes it's done to you without even subtlety? Why? Because I got pride. Exactly in the same way that Jesus doesn't. And in his love, he humbly submitted to that injustice. He bore our injustice so that we could be made whole. First of all, be made whole. Second of all, you got pride. Do your best to prayerfully leave that pride with him because it's not going to do you any good. You'll waste a lot of time thinking about what you should have said, what you should have done. And it will distract you and take away from your ability to instead get in there and do what really needs to be done. And if someone steps on your pride, they don't need you to go back and defend your pride. What they probably need is someone to help them with their hurt. And that's true whether it's the people you work with, or the people you live with, or the people you're buying groceries from. He bore your injustice, and you are forgiven and free. In love, bear the injustices of other people. Let that pride go. In love, instead be equipped to do what love needs to do without pride stopping it. Pride's one of the worst, most damaging sins. Where are you nursing yours? Because you are. What injustices have you failed to put down? Because unless you are really, really weird, you've got them. Jesus is the Christ. He's the Son of Man. He is the final, ultimate judge. Give what injustices you've received to Him. You make it right, you bring Him to heel, because I can't carry this anymore. It's in your hands. Being forgiven. This week, you're going to have people turn against you. They bite. We all bite. Drop their hurts. Pray for the eyes of love to see past their hurtfulness to the hurt that needs a selfless, loving hand. Please pray with me now. Lord, you endured an absolutely bogus trial, absolute injustice upon injustice, and you did not speak up, and I am amazed. And I thank you for that loving willingness to endure all of that and then the cross. I don't understand what humility like that looks like from the inside out, but I pray that you convert and change me. We pray that you would convert and change all of us to where we can be a bit more like you from the inside out. Thank you that you died, that we can be forgiven for all things, including our pride. Help us to be willing to bear the injustices of others and to instead reach out in love like you did. Thank you that we have everything because you came to do that. We praise you and thank you in your name. Amen.